have shifted focus to look at a text. It's a very sacred Buddhist text in the Tibetan tradition that was written by Shantideva. And it's a text that I've been focusing on more consistently in the last year. It's a text that I studied with my teacher, Kempo Pema Wangduk. And it's such a blessing to have an opportunity to explore it with you all. It's thought to be a roadmap of kind. It's a poem that was delivered by this student, Shantideva, who was a monk at the Nalanda University in the 8th century. But in the poem, what you find is a roadmap for how to navigate the experience of having a mind, right? Having a very tender heart, and most of us do have quite a tender heart, and how to find our way in the world with this very active mind that we have, and with this rather sensitive nature that is our human condition. And for the last few months, we were talking about the preliminary practices that involve cultivating what's known as bodhicitta, right, or the mind that wishes to be fully awake to the benefit of all beings, and that really orients our spiritual exploration toward the well-being of every human being, whether we know them or not, right, whether we feel a sense of ease with them or not, right, whether or not we've had difficulty. So it's a way to really cultivate a visceral sense of connection, bless you, right, an almost automatic, right, connection, an intuitive connection to all beings that compose this human family. And that's really considered the primary preliminary practice. And then we've begun looking at what are known as the skillful means, right? The various parts of our experience that can be cultivated so that we're able to be in life with a sense of readiness for whatever might happen. And as we've explored together, most of us experience many unforeseen experiences, right? Many unforeseen challenges and obstacles. And sometimes unforeseen opportunity, right? And capacities and healing shifts. And so the idea of these skillful means is that we can develop what we need to be able to enter into our experience, whatever that might hold. And so today we're going to shift to mindfulness, which comes fairly early on the Bodhisattva's way. And I know you're exploring mindfulness with Pamela, which is wonderful. And for that reason, I'm going to say a few words about what Shantideva offered us in terms of this practice of mindfulness. And I'll read to you just one or two stanzas. This comes from a translation, René Fusi, The Beautiful Way of Life. And he's a wonderful Buddhist teacher who realized that the original text, which I highly recommend, can feel quite culturally specific and can sometimes be a little bit abstruse. It's worth reading and it's worth grappling with, but sometimes the meaning can be tough to access because it is so culturally specific. And so René Fusi decided to work with the text and just make it as clear and as accessible as possible. And so when we come to the section on mindfulness, Shantideva begins by saying, without guarding the mind attentively, guarding one's practice is impossible. Without guarding the mind attentively, guarding one's practice is impossible. Even a crazed elephant can't cause as much harm as an untamed mind. But for a mind bound with mindfulness, everything becomes possible. This is a very radically optimistic statement, right? Basically, a mind that has been cultivated to stay attuned to reality is capable of dealing with whatever reality holds. This is quite remarkable. I think it's true. But for those of us who have developed some cynicism, right, if we're a New Yorker, we probably have. we like to have some doubt that's ready. It's good protection. But the historical Buddha said, don't take it on faith. Check it out. See what it's like to work very, very diligently with the mind, with great determination, and then see what becomes possible. Even the very things that we decided were for everybody else, but not me, right, might become possible. Right? The very things that seem so elusive that they drive us crazy, can become possible. So he goes on to say, wild animals, spirits, enemies, all will be tamed by having tamed this mind. Right? And again, it's a rather strong and provocative statement, because so often it's tempting to imagine that we are at the mercy of the external world. Right? Our minds will be relatively calm and settled if our environment is calm and settled. Or our minds will be upset and riled if our environment is upset and riled. And so in the Buddha Dharma, there's not a minimization of how we're influenced by the environment. Of course we are. Right, which is why we find spiritual community. We need places where we feel nurtured and where we get spiritual sustenance and where we get some temporary protection from the stressors of everyday life. However, it's very tempting to overemphasize our environment and underemphasize our interiority. The mind. Yeah. And I know I've read this stanza to you before, but it's such a pithy reminder. I cannot cover the planet with leather, but I can cover my feet. I cannot cover the planet with leather, but I can cover my feet. Likewise, I am unable to control external events. But if I tame my mind, what else needs to be controlled? Yeah. Now, I'm going to say something very grandiose. If I were to have written this, I might change the language a little bit. I might swap out control for something like skillfully navigate. So it's less about being coercive, right? It's less about forcing the mind to be present, right? And mindfulness, there are many different ways to describe mindfulness, but one way is to be non-reactively present, right? To bring consciousness to our experience. Yeah, non-reactively present. Which doesn't mean zoning out, right? Sometimes we can imagine the only way to be non-reactively present would be to dissociate completely, right? Mm-hmm. To really disconnect, which is a pitfall of mindfulness practice. Right? But the idea is, if we become extremely caring toward the mind, maybe the same way we would be with a beloved infant. And I don't say that to pass judgment on the mind, but just to evoke a sense of how caring we would be, right? If there were a baby that didn't have a caregiver that was sitting here, each one of us would be thinking about how to protect the baby. Is the baby warm enough, right? What does it need in order to feel well, to feel relatively safe, not perfectly, because none of us can be perfectly safe, but relatively, right? For the body and the mind to start to decompress so that the baby doesn't have to work too hard, right, to be concerned about the environment. Yeah. Now we can do something very similar with our own minds. And this was the idea, right? The essence, if you will, of mindfulness teachings. That if we work, and for most of us it takes constant work, right? Because the patterns of the mind are so powerful. And we all have them, right? We all have habits of mind that we have needed for our sense of safety, right? Especially interpersonally, or with groups, with systems. And those habits, sometimes, as we've discussed, they're transmitted intergenerationally, so our parents may have had them, and our grandparents, and our great-grandparents, etc. They're powerful. And so mindfulness practice does take real determination, and I would say a very gentle diligence, non-coercive diligence, so that we can ready the mind to enter into and explore what is most meaningful. And this is the point that I think can sometimes get left out of a secularized mindfulness. Right, my teacher, Kenpo Pemba, loves to tell audiences when he's teaching that when he first arrived from India in the early 80s, nobody had heard of mindfulness. I mean, it sounded very esoteric. Right, like some strange tantric practice. And now there's probably no corporation in New York City that hasn't heard of mindfulness and doesn't have a mindfulness coach. Right? It's really gotten very, very secularized, very decontextualized from its origins. And I think there's a place for that, right? The risk. Now, the pitfall is that we can then sometimes forget what mindfulness is for. Right? It can sound as though mindfulness is a way to de-stress. Right? We can feel a little more relaxed if the mind is settled. And that sounds good to me. I would say we probably could all benefit from feeling, right, a little more decompressed. Less anxious, right? Less depressed, less worried, less disturbed, right? Because there's a lot that can disturb us. But the practice of mindfulness is meant to ready the mind to really open to the truth of reality, which is that one, we have these precious human lives, right? Really extraordinary opportunity to work deeply, right, with ourselves so that we can be of enormous benefit to others. Right? And as we do so, as we cultivate that visceral feeling of connection, it starts to challenge that equally visceral sense of disconnection. Right? I mean, this is another theme in the Buddha Dharma that frequently, for many of us, almost all the time, there's the sense of being fundamentally disconnected. And that can feel very isolating. Right? It can feel lonely. And it can leave us feeling that no one can fully understand who we are, what we've lived through, what we're struggling with, and what we long for. Right? And so those feelings of disconnection can cause a tremendous amount of pain and suffering. Yeah. And probably to some degree you've all felt that suffering. Right? It's quite pervasive. But the historical Buddha and all the teachers who have followed want to suggest, based on their experience, not based on pure faith in the teachings, but based on really giving it a try, we actually co-create each other. Right? I mean, our brain chemistry is changing right now in dependence upon the experience of being together. Some shift in our nervous system, our autonomic nervous system, is taking place because we're here at All Souls on a snowy day talking about mindfulness. Right? So that's how intimately connected we are. Right? Our brains will have changed when we leave here because we were here together. And when we're working with the teaching of mindfulness, we're more likely to keep orienting toward that reality rather than being pulled away. And there's so much that can pull us away. Really, they're endless, right? There are now endless things that can pull us away from that reality. Endless responsibilities and lots of things that we can explore on the internet, a lot of information that we can be gathering about all sorts of things. It can make it so very challenging, right, to bring the mind back, to enter into reality. And again, I would suggest with some friendly feeling, right, that non-reactive can sound, again, a little bit maybe too cool. But with some heart-centric feeling of, I'm right here. Yeah. And so in preparation for today, I was rereading Thich Nhat Hanh's beautiful book, The Miracle of Mindfulness, which I highly recommend. And he's such an important teacher, because this is a man who's been through enormous amounts of loss and trauma. Lost many, many beloved people, lost his country, right? Nearly lost his life many times. Right? So this is someone who can really speak from experience of what it means to be able to cultivate that ability to non-reactively enter into reality and then notice what that stirs. And so he gives many examples of when drinking tea, just drinking tea mindfully, or when walking, just walk mindfully. Right? And so with his words in my mind as I was coming here, I was hearing the crunch of the snow, right? And I was noticing some worry arising about all of you who might be walking here in the snow. Right? Just noticing, okay, my mind has left, right, the crunch, the sounds, the feel. Right? And then just to notice where the mind has gone. That's mindfulness. Right? right? So that there's some opportunity to come back and enter into present reality. Yeah. Does that make sense? So, I'm aware that we're just on the other side of Thanksgiving, and you know the holidays can be quite a provocative time, right? For some people, it's a joyful time, and for many people, it's a stressful time because it stirs a lot of longing, right, for loving relationship. Connection and community. It can also stir a lot of grief, right, as we miss the people who are no longer with us in the way they once were. And so I want to say somewhat ironically, because it's a contrast from the cultural message we get about how we should feel during the holidays, many of us struggle to be mindful. Because it's a time when there's so much that's happening internally, right? A lot of strong feeling about how we got to this moment in life and where we could have been and where other people are, right? There's a lot that gets mobilized. And so it can be tempting for the mind to just want to follow these various arisings. I do that because I find the arisings very interesting, but also they're compelling. Right? What's happened to us throughout our lives is very compelling. The only problem is that, as Fiona Hill evoked during the hearings, we can easily go down the rabbit hole. I loved it, I have to admit. I just loved it when she said, don't go down that rabbit hole, right? That was a teaching of mindfulness. Very tempting for the mind to keep following loops, right? Especially if they're emotionally charged, and especially if they seem linked to protection of some kind. Yeah. So often, when the mind is looping over the thing that happened that we can't believe happened, or the thing that didn't happen that needed to happen, right? We're trying to get a sense of control and safety and protection. The only challenge is that it usually means that the mind has actually gone down, I would say, a kind of psycho-spiritual rabbit hole. And so the challenge is just to notice that. Right? Where did my mind just go? How long did it stay there? How strong was the experience? In a way, to somewhat dispassionately just discern, right? What was it like for the mind to go there, rather than getting stuck in the narrative, right? Because you might tell yourself, well, my mind just went to how incredibly disappointing my family is because I told them repeatedly what needed to happen and it didn't happen, right? Or my friend, right? Or my mind went there because I can't believe this is happening at this time. So again, we tend to gather a lot of evidence for why the mind needs to just follow, right, whatever's gotten stirred. But the teaching of mindfulness wants to suggest we can gently, we can skillfully notice where the mind tends to go. I would say especially notice the stories, the narratives that we are telling ourselves repeatedly. And with respect, because these stories, as you know, I'm a clinician too, so the stories I think are worth being curious about. But it's also so very helpful to let them settle Doesn't mean they have to go away. They probably won't anyway. But to let them settle so that the mind can just come back to what we're experiencing in this moment. Bless you.
Thank you.
And we'll do some practice, but this is very helpful as a way to allow the mind to have some rest so that it can actually open to what's happening. Yeah,
Ellen. I just wonder, I was caught by, as you were, by that phrase that she used, but I was also down the rabbit hole,
mm-hmm.
but I was also confused because I wasn't sure whether down the rabbit hole was a safe place. I mean, I think that's where rabbits go. They don't want to be safe. They go down the rabbit hole. Or was it a place, or did she mean it's going to go down this rabbit hole with all the other mess that people are talking about?
Right.
And I therefore I ask you how you see it.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, if we think about it developmentally, right, the ways in which we learn to stay safe early in life are quite necessary. Right? We do evolutionarily, right? We do what it takes to survive. But almost invariably, the ways we learn to adapt to survive become maladaptive over time. Right? And so I think that's what she was referencing. She didn't do this specifically, and I'll turn the conversation too political if I get into the specifics, but more generally she's saying, I understand why this narrative has an appeal. It is protecting you, right? It's protecting your job. It's protecting your sense of group cohesion, right? But what we're going to lose, the suffering that will be generated, is far greater than this momentary sense of safety that's evoked by the rabbit hole. Now, that's exactly relevant to the practice of mindfulness, right? Because again, we have such powerful imprinting that tells us definitely go down the rabbit hole. Again, it can feel instinctual, right? Like a rabbit. Find some space that can't be seen and burrow in. Yeah, it's very appealing. Right? On some level, it's very appealing. But so much we're going to miss. We're going to miss reality. Right? We're going to miss entering into the truth of reality. We're going to burrow into our own momentary need to survive. Right? But we are going to miss the truth of our inner resources, intelligence, right, and joy, right, and resilience, determination. Right? A kind of psycho-spiritual strength, compassion, wisdom. We're going to miss all of that, right, if we give in to that momentary need, right, to stay safe, to burrow in. And so you begin to see that the teaching of mindfulness is so much more than the capacity to de-stress. It's really about the capacity to come out of our places of protection, right? That, of course, we have needed at some point and we will need again, and to interrupt those patterns so that we're able to learn so much more about reality, what's happening both inside ourselves, inside others, and collectively. So before I pause, because I would love to hear from you, I'll just read you the last stanza in this mindfulness section. Mindfulness in brief is this: repeatedly checking the state of body and mind. I must put all this into practice. For what benefit is there in merely reading the doctor's prescription? I like that. I'll read it again. Mindfulness in brief is this: repeatedly checking the state of body and mind. In other words, because we've cultivated that capacity to just be present reactively, we're going to be much more able to notice what's happening in the mind, what's happening in the body, right? And especially for those of us who are attuned to the body, we can use the body to help us understand what's happening in the mind, right? We're not going to get lost elsewhere. We're going to be able to come back and notice what we're feeling, experiencing. And then Shantideva offers a very Buddhist commandment. Right? You're going to find a lot of suggestions to be extremely determined in the Buddha Dharma. I must put all this into practice. Right? Rather than being curious from time to time, which is also lovely, right? But to really be determined to implement the teaching of mindfulness, right? For what benefit is there in merely reading the doctor's prescription? And the historical Buddha Shakyamuni was often described as a great physician and a great psychologist, right? And he spoke at length about how tempting it can be to read the prescription and not take the medicine, right? Which is why, metaphorically, we all have medicine cabinets filled with stuff that's in there that we never took. We took one, right? Or the fridge is filled with frozen bone broth, right, that we bought 6 years ago. But do anything with it? Maybe not. It's just very, very human. But Shantideva wanted to say, please don't stop, right, with the mere curiosity. See what it's like to practice. And if you do, and this is something that my teacher is always reminding me and others, mindfulness will protect you. Yeah, mindfulness will protect you. In fact, there is no greater protection. There is truly no greater protection than a mind that is present, right, that is receptive to our experience, that is willing to learn, that is noticing who's around us and what they might be feeling and needing. It is the most reliable protection we have.